6. The strategic question, in which you get to the heart of overwhelm and discover the question at the heart of every good strategy. More impact, more meaning. You know how there's some work that you do that you absolutely love? It's the work that absorbs you and excites you. It's not just that the work is making a difference and having an impact. It's that the work means something to you. Frankly, this is the work that, when you signed up for this job, you hoped you'd be doing. And then there's all that other work you've got to get through. At Box of Crayons, we make the distinction between good work, the everyday, get it done, this is my job description type of work, and great work, the work with both more meaning and more impact, all with the goal of helping organizations and their people do less good work and more great work. You can probably imagine how things might shift if you and your team were all doing, say, 10% more great work. But quite frankly, who has the time? In fact, if the chapter about the lazy question, how can I help, makes you a little uneasy, you might be fearing that someone will actually give you an answer. You're already behind on emails, meetings, deliverables, exercise, reading, and family time. You're at full capacity. How could you possibly say yes to anything more? Let's ban "it's a good busy." At the same time, perversely, in these hurly-burly days of endless connectivity, lean organizations, and globalization, it's de rigueur to humble brag about being overcommitted and overwhelmed. "How are you doing?" they say. "Busy," you reply, "but a good busy." We're slowly waking up to the fact that being busy is no measure of success. George Bernard Shaw was onto something years ago when one of his maxims for revolutionaries stated, "The reasonable man adapts himself to the world. The unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself. Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man." 4-Hour Workweek author Tim Ferriss drove the point home recently when he said, "Being busy is a form of laziness, lazy thinking, and indiscriminate action." And that's not the good type of laziness I was promoting in the previous chapter. Let's also ban "work smarter, not harder." People have lots of snappy advice for you. Work smarter, not harder. Be more strategic. These maxims tend to be TBU. True but useless sound bites that sound good but are impossible to act upon. In fact, strategic has become an overused qualifier, something we add to anything that we want to sound more important, more useful, more thoughtful, more good. This isn't just a meeting. It's a strategic meeting, a strategic report, a strategic lunch date, a strategic purchase of that fantastic pair of Jeffrey West shoes I can't really afford but have been admiring for a while. It can all leave employees supremely indifferent to the idea of strategy. When you combine the overuse of the term with the fact that anything to do with strategy is often seen as being their work, when they are anyone 2 or 3 levels higher than the employees, well, you're likely to encounter a nasty but predictable case of the spots, strategic plans on top shelf. But strategy isn't a thick PowerPoint document gathering dust somewhere. It's far more fundamental and common than that. Of the many definitions of strategy that I've seen, I think I like Michael Porter's best when he said, "The essence of strategy is choosing what not to do." The strategic question. If you're saying yes to this, what are you saying no to? This question is more complex than it sounds, which accounts for its potential. To begin with, you're asking people to be clear and committed to their yes. Too often, we kinda, sorta, half-heartedly agree to something, Or more likely, there's a complete misunderstanding in the room as to what's been agreed to. Have you ever heard or uttered the phrase, "I never said I was going to do that"? Me too. So to ask, let's be clear, what exactly are you saying yes to, brings the commitment out of the shadows. If you then ask, what could being fully committed to this idea look like? It brings things into even sharper, bolder focus. But a yes is nothing without the no that gives it boundaries and form. And in fact, you're uncovering two types of no answers here, the no of omission and the no of commission. The first type of no applies to the options that are automatically eliminated by your saying yes. If you say yes to this meeting, you're saying no to something else that's happening at the same time as the meeting. Understanding this kind of no helps you understand the implications of the decision. The second type of no you're uncovering, which will likely take the conversation another level deeper, is what you now need to say to make the yes happen. It's all too easy to shove another yes into the bag of our overcommitted lives, hoping that in a Harry Potter magical sort of way, it will somehow all be accommodated. This second type of no puts the spotlight on how to create the space and focus energy and resources that you'll need to truly do that yes. You can use the 3P model you read about in the Kickstart question chapter to make sure you cover all the bases. Projects. What projects do you need to abandon or postpone? What meetings will you no longer attend? What resources do you need to divert to the yes? People. What expectations do you need to manage? From what drama triangle dynamics will you extract yourself? What relationships will you let wither? Patterns. What habits do you need to break? What old stories or dated ambitions do you need to update? What beliefs about yourself do you need to let go of? When should you say no? And when should you say yes? I asked my LinkedIn community what they thought were good reasons and bad reasons to say either yes or no. Here are some of the answers they gave me. Bad reasons to say yes. I'll do anything to have you get off the phone or leave the office. I know that I'm not actually going to do it. I think this will make people really like me. Habit. Bad reasons to say no. I don't like the person, unless I really don't like the person. I'm comfortable and I don't want things to change. Attack is the best form of defense. Habit. Good reasons to say yes. I was curious about the request and asked questions, and the person gave me good answers. I'm clear on what I'm going to stop doing so I can start doing this. It's great work for me, work that will have an impact and that means something. My boss has made it clear that it's not negotiable. Good reasons to say no. I was curious about the request and asked questions, and the person gave me good answers, so now I know it's not a fit. I've thought about what my core priorities are, and I'm willing to hold the line. I'm trying to build a reputation as someone who's strategic and thoughtful. How to say no when you can't say no. Part 1. For most of us, there are two groups of people to whom it is easiest to say no. Those closest to us, spouses and kids, and those distant from us. Hello, evening telemarketers. It's much harder to say no to everyone else, which unfortunately tends to be everyone we work with. That difficulty is exacerbated by most corporate cultures where the default answer is yes, or at the bare minimum, probably. Bill Mr. Simplicity Jensen taught me that the secret to saying no was to shift the focus and learn how to say yes more slowly. What gets us into trouble is how quickly we commit without fully understanding what we're getting ourselves into or even why we're being asked. Saying yes more slowly means being willing to stay curious before committing, which means asking more questions. Why are you asking me? Whom else have you asked? When you say this is urgent, what do you mean? According to what standard does this need to be completed? By when? If I couldn't do all of this, but could just do a part, what part would you have me do? What do you want me to take off my plate so I can do this? Being willing to stay curious like this will likely provoke one of four types of responses, three of which might be helpful. The first response, and the one that's not useful, is that the person tells you to stop with the annoying questions and just get on with the task. Depending on the person, the culture, and the urgency of the task, sometimes it's clear that you're expected to do what you're told. The second response is that he has good answers to all your questions. That's a win for you, because it means that the request was thoughtful, and he's not asking you just because you have a pulse and yours was the first email address that started to populate the to address line. Third, he doesn't have the answers, but might be willing to find them for you. That's good. That buys you time, at a minimum, and it's quite possible that he'll never get back to you. And finally, he may just say this: "You're too much like hard work. I'm going to find someone who says yes more quickly than you do." In a 2002 Harvard Business Review article, "Beware the Busy Manager," Heike Bruch and Sumantra Ghoshal suggested that only 10% of managers had the right focus and energy to work on the stuff that matters. To be frank, 10% sounds high to me. But most likely you can think of someone in your organization who seems to be able to hold the line and stop that aggregation of small tasks and additional responsibilities that, for the rest of us, eventually consume our lives. That person might not be the best liked person in the organization. The need to be liked drives that drama triangle rescuer response of, "Yes, I'll do that." But she's likely to be successful, senior, and respected. And that's because she knows how to say yes more slowly than you do. How to say no when you can't say no, part two. It's awkward saying no to something because actually you're saying no to someone. And now people are involved, so we're into the messy awkwardness of dashing hopes, stomping on toes, and having people think that you've let them down. One secret from the world of facilitation, which we saw in a different context in the discussion about coaching the ghost, is to create a third point, an object that you can identify as the thing you're saying no to, which isn't the person. For instance, if you write down someone's request on a bit of paper or a flip chart, you can then point to it and say, "I'm afraid I have to say no to this," which is a little better than, "I'm afraid I have to say no to you." Say yes to the person, but say no to the task. To be on a quest is nothing more or less than to become an asker of questions. Sam Keen. The other five strategic questions. There are an awful lot of books on strategy, and most of them you can skip. If you were to go and grab just one book on the topic, here's the one I'd recommend: Roger Martin and A.G. Laffley's Playing to Win. Laffley was Procter & Gamble's CEO during a period of great success and was so good he came back for a second stint. And Martin, former dean of the University of Toronto's Rothman School of Management and a successful author, was his trusted advisor. They break strategy down into just five core questions that need to be answered. Five questions that scale down to the individual and team and scale up to a complex, global, multi-billion-dollar organization. These questions are not linear. Answering one will influence the answer to the one that follows and likely to the one that preceded it. It is the process of working back and forth between them, creating alignment between your answers, that is the strength of this process. It was Eisenhower who said, "Plans are useless, but planning is indispensable." And while that's a little black and white, It's also true that the result of these questions is that they force great planning. Here are the five questions. What is our winning aspiration? Framing the choice as winning rules out mediocrity as an option. If you want to win, you need to know what game you're playing and with and against whom. What impact do you want to have in and on the world? Where will we play? Boiling the ocean is rarely successful. Choosing a sector, geography, product, channel, and customer allows you to focus your resources. How will we win? What's the defendable difference that will open up the gap between you and the others? What capabilities must be in place? Not just what do you need to do, but how will it become and stay a strength? What management systems are required? It's easy enough to measure stuff. It's much harder to figure out what you want to measure that actually matters. The question behind the questions is our strategic question. What will you say no to if you're truly saying yes to this? Martin and Laffley put it like this. Do remember that strategy is about winning choices. It is the coordinated and integrated set of five very specific choices. As you define your strategy, choose what you will do and what you will not do. Meg Whitman, CEO of HP and such a fan of Playing to Win that she's made every manager read it, puts it thus. The process forces the tough trade-offs. Build your new habit here. When this happens, write out the moment, the person, and perhaps the feelings that are your trigger. The trigger here is when you see that someone's about to move from overwhelmed to really overwhelmed by adding more to their list, or when they're wimping out by not making a choice but fudging things by saying yes to everything, or when the pace of work is just getting to be too much and you can see scope creep happening for people and their projects. In short, whenever someone's making a decision to commit to something new. Instead of write out the old habit you want to stop doing. Be specific. For this question, it could have something to do with taming your advice monster. The instead of is when you hope that you and your team can defy the laws of physics and just keep adding more stuff to your capacity. So it's when you notice yourself in rescuer mode, where you say yes to everything to keep them happy, or victim mode, when you feel you have no choice but to say yes, and you want to pull out of that. I will... Describe your new habit. Stop the rush to action and towards the cliffs of overwhelm, and ask, what will you say no to make this yes rock solid and real? Watch it work. Watch the short videos at thecoachinghabit.com/videos to deepen your learning and help turn insight into action. Rapid fire strategic thinking, planning, and doing. If you're wanting to up your strategic game, then the strategic question is a great place to start. If you want more than what's presented in this video, we share a one-page strategic planning tool that will give your plans a new focus and rigor. How to say no when you can't say no. Saying no is tricky, particularly if you work in an organizational culture where yes is the expected answer. In this video, you'll find strategies to build up your no muscle. From the Box of Crayons Lab. Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002 for his work on the psychology of judgment and decision-making, and the field more generally known as behavioral economics. He's best known for his book Thinking, Fast and Slow, which explains that we have two decision-making processes, a fast, instinctual, gut-feeling one, and a slower, more rational one. The fast-thinking approach is very good and accurate, except when it isn't, And then our various cognitive biases make for very poor decision-making indeed. The strategy question can help us avoid at least two of these biases. The first bias is the planning fallacy, which can be summed up as saying that we're lousy at figuring out how much time something will take us to complete. It's a combination of overestimating our abilities and, to add insult to injury, underestimating the degree to which we are overestimating. We think we can do more than we can. The strategy question helps us be more realistic about what's actually possible. The second bias, known as prospect theory, tells us that loss and gain are not measured equally. Losing $100, say, feels worse than gaining $100 feels good. One result of the bias is that once we've got something, not only do we not want to let it go, but we also tend to overvalue its worth. Asking the strategic question shines a light on what we're holding on to, so we might better weigh up what's worth keeping and what might need to be set free. Question Masterclass 7. Acknowledge the answers you get. Carly Rae Jepsen's 2012 summertime hit, Call Me Maybe, was more than a little popular. The video, with its great twist at the end, has north of 700 million views on YouTube. The song is also one of the latest examples of a very old form of music, call and response. Carly Rae sings, "Hey, I just met you," and the music responds, "Cue violins." Carly Rae sings again, "And this is crazy," and again, the music replies. You can trace this pattern back through classics like Muddy Waters' Mannish Boy to the deep roots of folk music and blues. You're now fully aware of the advice monster, and you're staying focused on the questions rather than rushing to offer advice and suggestions. Bravo! Now bring in the structure of the call and response. Remember to acknowledge the person's answers before you leap to the next, "And what else?" You don't need to say much. This isn't about judging people. It's about encouraging them and letting them know that you listened and heard what they said. Some of my favorite replies are, "Fantastic. I like it. Good one. Nice. Yes, that's good. Mm-hmm." I bet you've got some of your own, too. What would you add to this list? Here's your new habit. When this happens, the person gives an answer to a question I've asked, instead of rushing on to the next question, I will acknowledge the reply by saying, "Yes, that's good."